This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 90, brought to you in association with Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Romy Savova, CEO and founder of PensionBee, an online pensions provider. In the good old days, you joined a company which had a final salary pension plan, i.e. you retired with an annual pension which was a sizable fraction of your final pension. There was also state pension taken at a decent age. Some of those folks older and wiser than me at Climeworts I met on golf courses after they'd retired, and I have to tell you, it was a fantastic standard of living. If something moves somewhere, then something else moves from somewhere else. That's not very clear, is it? Anyway, political power now resides with corporates. Look at how scandalously US tech giants bleed economies and virtually avoid any taxes. Also, we see increasing centralized political power. The cost of this power moving to the corporate and to the state is that it moves from the people. In the UK, in essence, everyone's mandatory pensions contributions were embezzled by the state, i.e. spent at the time rather than invested, as they were in saner countries like Norway. And the media and economists talk about a pensions crisis. There would be no crisis if the politicians and permanent state hadn't done a Robert Maxwell with the money. On the other side, there's been a massive risk transfer from the corporate to the individual. So by now, all the risk generally lies with the people, whereas in the past it lay with the corporate, hence being given a defined salary upon retirement. Behind all the complex schemes, basically, there's next to no way of getting such a generous pension as those who were fortunate enough to be born 10 or 20 years before I was. At least we've got out recently of the ghastly trap which required you to buy an annuity upon retirement. Again, having seen this over time, it was a real roll of the dice. Have a million in your pension pot and retire when interest rates happen to be 15% and you get, broadly speaking, £15,000 for life. Retire when they're 1.5% and you have to live on £1,500 per annum for life. Super low interest rates have also been called a tax on savers, and so even capital accumulation can't generate a high income from being turned into cash. The acronym FORIST. I saw in an article recently the four types of pension called GPP, DB, DC, AC, and that didn't even mention SIPPs, which a bunch of my chums have. Add to this high and still quite impenetrable in many cases charging by incumbents. Which of us knows our pension costs per annum? Throw in the gig economy, whereby the average person now works in 11 companies over the life, and it's all a right pickle. Interestingly, there's much action and much blah 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 around open banking. But I ain't heard nothing about open investment, of which of course pensions is the major subset. Now isn't that a curious thing? It's into this decades in the making pickle that PensionBee hopes, if not to wave a magic wand and make it all go away, then at least to give us a better deal with better service. Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Romy. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike.
So when we met last week, it was a big week for awards in that my sponsors, Blue Motor Finance and Smart Pension, both won awards, I think, at the same black tie dinner. And I read somewhere that you were the Woman of the Year, which I thought was an impressive achievement, as there were about 3.5 billion when I last counted.
Well, not quite Woman of the Year, but Entrepreneur of the Year.
Well, it's going in the right direction, isn't it? Really?
it's getting there. At a Women in IT Excellence Awards evening. And it's quite funny because I often hear people saying, where are all the women in tech? And I can tell you exactly where they were.
Well, generally that's the boys in tech actually saying, where are all the women in tech? Where were they?
They were at the awards.
Ah, were sort of tech boys allowed along with their beards and tech shirts?
There were a few token men present.
I like token men.
Which made it quite a unique evening, of course.
Ah, excellent. And how long has this award been going on then?
They didn't give the history of it, but I imagine it's been going on for a couple of years, and I can only see it continuing into the future.
And this is tech as a whole, this isn't just FinTech Woman of the Year?
No. So we had many sort of established enterprise-like companies represented, universities represented. There are lots of women in tech working in universities.
Yes, that's interesting actually, because we were touching on this before, and we shall definitely do a big steer around the whole identity politics and whether the world is for or against old people or females or all sorts of stuff like that. But I think that it's certainly the case that something like this that showcases women that have been successful in all domains is really helpful for younger women in terms of, oh, I can do that. Because as far as I'm concerned, the most disempowering thing is to believe whether it's right or whether it's wrong, that you can't do something. If you can't do something, then you just start limiting yourself. Right. If you think it might be a bit tricky, because society may not make it easy for you, well, somehow you might overcome it.
Yes, I think it has a lot to do with your attitude to things. If you think you can do something, you probably can. And so getting more people to think that they can do things means they probably will.
Yes, indeed, as Henry Ford said. So you haven't always worked in Pension B because for a large chunk of your life, you hadn't actually thought of Pension B, so you couldn't work there because you hadn't created it. So what was it that sort of led you along the path to thinking of Pension B and then creating it?
Well, I started off my career at Goldman Sachs, where I was working in corporate finance, sort of looking after the credit risk of major global banks and sovereigns. So I'd always been in the financial services space. I left and got an MBA at Harvard Business School and came back and joined Morgan Stanley, covering banks, insurance companies, asset managers from an M&A and capital raising perspective. So I knew all the big guys, knew the business models, knew some of the challenges, but it wasn't until I left Morgan Stanley and had to move my own pension that I discovered just how difficult it is if you're an actual consumer.
And talking of moving pensions, actually one of the dimensions that hadn't really crossed my mind, but it does come up in terms of access to banking facilities, is the cross-country angle. So you were with these investment banks in the States?
So I started off at Goldman in New York, moved to London, and with Morgan Stanley, I was in London the whole time.
Right, okay. So, I mean, maybe it doesn't apply to you as an individual, depending on how the pensions thing worked, but let's put you as an individual aside, but just in passing. So how does this international thing go? Let's say somebody works in the States for 10 years and in the UK for 10 years and then in Germany for 10 years or whatever. I assume that it's something of a complete nightmare to transfer cross-border these days, given that it's a bit of a challenge, as you're going to come on to, transferring even within the UK.
It is definitely a nightmare. And part of that is due to regulation. So pensions are very different in every country and they are regulated in a non-standardized format. You know, if you're in the UK, there's one set of regulations. In the US, there's a different one. And so the taxmen really worry that if you move from one country to another, you're trying to arbitrage the tax rules. And so they make it as difficult as possible.
And without moaning about corporates, as I said earlier, the US tech giants can actually afford enough lawyers to make sure that they can sort of move the money around as they wish.
Well, not pension money.
No. Well, I don't know what they'd do about that, actually. My favourite statistic is that Apple have got more foreign exchange reserves than the Bank of England and the UK Treasury put together.
That is a scary thought.
It's probably a scary thought, but actually the answer to this is probably that the UK Treasury and the Bank of England have got next to no foreign exchange reserves by now. So moving on to this very vexed question, and I'm glad that you're the expert, because I'm certainly not. I've just ended up confused many years ago by the whole pension thing. Into this whole question of pensions in the gig economy, pensions in a world where people change jobs all the time, pensions in a world where it's kind of up to you to look after yourself as you go through time. There were sort of five major areas that I thought of. One, visibility. Second is integration. Third, portability, costs, and then data, as we're living in a fintech age. So let's just slice these off one by one. So in terms of visibility, so a simple example of that is how many of you listeners out there know the value of your pensions. I saw some statistic that said that 59% of the population do not know how much is in their pension. I would actually have guessed it was something like 99% of the population don't know what's in their pension.
Well, I think 59% is pretty bad, especially taking into account that around 80% of people do know how much is in their bank account. And your pension is really supposed to be your second biggest personal finance asset after your home. And so not knowing how much is in it is actually quite shocking.
Yes, and I think the other thing that, looking at this topic a little bit, has been impressed upon me, and it covers the visibility in a sense, we can put it into various categories, is that some way, and I read an article by my chum Will from Smart Pension recently on the pensions dashboard, which you can explain to us, that some way of folks actually knowing how much is in their pension today, and how much, if they suddenly sort of fast forward the rest of their life and nothing happened, they would actually have to live on.
That is a very low number, usually.
Yes, it's a very low number in my case. So I'll be podcasting until I'm 99, but I hope that fintech keeps going, actually. That almost in the absence of folks knowing what that number is in terms of the kind of current value today and the future flow of things, then people, by and large, aren't going to do the right thing. So this seems to me absolutely critical to the whole thing, especially in the gig economy. You go, oh, I've got some there, I've got some there, I've got some there. I'm only 30, what do I care? It's decades away, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So how is the process going in terms of, either by the state or private companies, folks finding it much easier to know what they have got?
Well, I think there's quite a lot to be optimistic about. So today, your main visibility over your pension will be a piece of paper that hopefully arrives once a year and tells you the balance, maybe on page 16 or 17, and you're kind of left to figure out what this means 30 years later on. Now, the government is working on a new initiative to create a pensions dashboard. And this dashboard will gather data from the major pension providers and some of the smaller pension providers and aggregate it into one view so that a saver can log in and see how much they have in a pension that they may have gotten from a job 10 years ago or the job they had yesterday and eventually the other 8 or 10 jobs that they plan on having in their lives.
And so you used the words optimism and state in the same sentence, which an old cynic like me generally doesn't. So putting this into a little bit of context, this pensions dashboard idea and the state has been floating around, quotes, for some time. And I happen to know, because I read Will's article, that random factoid, Sweden has had one for 13 years.
Yes.
I don't normally associate sort of the state, the government, with very rapid and successful IT programs. So I assume we can't expect to get a government pensions dashboard by this Christmas, shall we say?
Well, it's not coming this Christmas. The official deadline is 2019, and there has been a lot of progress.
That'll be 2020 then.
Well, if it's 2020, I still think that's a good outcome. But there has been a lot of progress in terms of making the technology that would power the dashboard. And so actually, from a technological standpoint, it's not that difficult to make a dashboard. The challenge comes down to what is the data that's going to be feeding the dashboard. And so I know you want to talk about data. And with the dashboard, it becomes really, really critical that the data sitting underneath it is clean. And actually, that's where the major challenge lies.
Absolutely. So let's leave that to the data section. And as you say, this is not like the NHS records scheme, which was a well-known fiasco in terms of state delivery of vast IT projects, where the state ended up being sued by Accenture for non-delivery. Because basically, once, in a sense, just looking at a little simple spreadsheet, you've been 11 companies, there's the 11 lines. As you say, it's just the data, it's just the numbers. And there's a lot behind that, which is the clean data, which is organisations efficiently and electronically providing it, da-da-da-da-da. So behind my sort of joking about it, the front end is actually fairly simple, but
exactly,
it's the back end challenge of plugging it into a million potential providers and getting them all to deliver timely data, yada-yada-yada. So let's come on to the data. So talking about 11 lines in a spreadsheet or however many companies you've worked for, we then got the challenge of integration, which led quite nicely. So people have got loads of pots all over the place. So how does integration work in your mind?
Well, there are already some companies like us that are helping people to find and combine their pensions into one new plan so they can always see one balance. I think that for many people, however, the dashboard will be their first experience with seeing their pensions in the same spot. And my understanding is that it's mainly a data cleansing exercise that the providers need to go through, because the actual data fields that need to be submitted into the technology are not that many and are not that complicated. So if we can rely on the providers to clean up the data, then it should be fairly easy.
Okay, I like your optimism, and it really helps to found the fintechs by being optimistic in terms of a great German saying that the devil is in the detail. And thinking about a couple of my pots, I've got, you know, a bunch of cash that the accountant said I should bung into something, and I bunged it into the Legal & General UK tracker fund. So that's fairly simple because that has a value every day. Then separately, where it's slightly less simple, I have some pension fund from Clymore Benson days, which was a final salary pension scheme. And when I was busy getting divorced about 15 years ago, I asked for valuations of this. And I was quite horrified because I asked for a valuation and then kind of basically did a deal with my then wife. And then 6 months later, I thought I'd update it and it had doubled in value, which is kind of good news and bad news.
You must have done a good deal.
Must have done a good deal. And then 6 months later, it had halved again. So frankly, the actual numbers were all over the show. And as I was very familiar with markets at the time, nothing could change in terms of equity markets or interest rates. And I queried it with whichever sort of administrators were doing it at the time. So there's that kind of stuff, which may, I think, actually come into the dirty data point that you're making. They could have just looked at the wrong line of their massive spreadsheet for the sake of argument.
That would not surprise me. But I think that with new regulations that we have coming in, so GDPR in particular, the providers are going to have to clean up their data and move onto more modern systems, because the requirements that are going to be placed on them in terms of protecting that data and knowing when they have permission to use it, and importantly, being required to make it portable for the consumer, means that you have to have confidence in the accuracy of the underliers.
Absolutely. And to me, it's inconceivable that my pension pot would have doubled in 6 months and then halved in the next 6 months.
Especially if nothing's happening in equity markets.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And interest rates. So that's one of the challenges. But the other point was that, and it's a long time since I looked at this, off the top of my head, I've got, I don't know what it is, 20, 30, 40,000 pounds, of salary per annum from whatever date it is. And then it's kind of things like indexed by the lower of the RPI or 5%, or, you know, complicated terms and conditions like that. So coming back to, I eventually get back to where I started, going back to the challenge about how simple the data is that's going into the government dashboard. Obviously, the funds is just a value, but some of these other schemes have got lots of details in terms of how the value of that is or isn't going to grow over time, and you've got to make some assumptions about, oh, well, inflation's less than 5, or it's more than 5, or, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I just wonder how all that complications will be handled. Or is it just old people like me who've got sort of residues of that, and most people don't have that kind of stuff?
It's a combination of the two things. So on the one hand, these days, most of the administrators that do administer defined benefit pensions should have the technology and should be investing in the technology that can value DB pensions on a daily basis. Whether they're doing it is another question, but the technology to do it should exist. Now, on the other hand, the dashboard is really to help people who have had 11 different jobs, who have completely lost track of their pensions. You know, the real concern here is that people are going and spending 1 year in one job, another year in another job, a third year in a third job, and 50 years from now, they should have amassed pension savings, but they just don't know where these pensions are. Now, you sort of know where they are.
Yeah, you know exactly which drawer
you're keeping that documentation
in. Well, it's funny you say that, actually, but when you were talking before, I thought, yes, I remember receiving something from LNG, but I haven't received anything from the Germans for a long time, where my pension is now residing after multiple corporate takeovers, actually. So I shall go back home and check a last time.
Best advice is to try and get it online as soon as you can, so that you can always log in and see the value. And, you know, aside from the pension dashboard, pension providers are making an effort to be more digital and more available to their customers. We are built exclusively to be digital, but I think many others are following in our footsteps.
Yes, yes. Well, it's certainly on a journey right now. And from my perspective, it's about 2/3 of the journey is probably to go. So that then starts to talk about issues like portability. As you say, somebody who's going to work in 24 companies, they'd have trouble filing the piece of paper for 24 years, and life comes and goes, and then they sort of forget the odd one and all that kind of stuff. So I was very impressed by a piece of work that you guys did on something you called the Robin Hood Index.
That's right.
Robin Hood, actually, didn't he steal from the rich to give to
the
poor?
Oh, this debate again.
So on the one hand, it's a really good name because it's attracted lots of press attention. But on the other hand, it's sort of the wrong way around and people ask you the same stupid question over and over again.
Well, you had to think about it, right? So you already spent quite a long time thinking about Robin Hood.
Shouldn't it be the Sheriff of Nottingham Index or something? Anyway, we'll explain why, and people can make their own mind up about the names. You did some work, particularly around costs and portability. We'll come to costs in a second, but just on the portability point, I was very shocked by some of the stats in your Robin Hood Index in terms of how much some, this is a technical phrase, bastards, actually steal from people if you want to try and transfer the money away from them. Huge sums of money for exit fees.
Absolutely.
I mean, the highest exit fee was...
Well, we've seen one of 78%.
So anyway, let's just stop there, and everybody who's driving the car, just pull over to the side of the road, sit down, take your hands off the steering wheel. So that means if you transfer, I mean, obviously, that means you transfer your money out of said provider, you lose 78%.
Yes.
I mean, why aren't those people in jail talking of Robin Hood and Sheriff Nottingham?
Well, the regulations haven't caught up with them yet.
So the regulation actually not say there is a maximum exit fee?
So there is a maximum exit fee for people over the age of 55 who are accessing pension freedoms. So they are fortunate enough to have a cap of 1% on exit fees.
I'm all right then.
Anyone younger, it's luck of the draw. But in our experience, exit fees really only exist in around 2 to 3% of all pension policies, because many providers have been forward-looking and have gotten rid of these. But there are a handful of providers who have insisted on maintaining these exit fees. Many of them have gone so far as to rename the exit fees. So they actually call them things like market value reductions. And you'll get a whole bunch of people debating about whether this is an exit fee or not. But anything that reduces the value of your pension to another value once you do a transfer is an exit fee.
Absolutely. It's times like this. I'm sort of somewhat cynical about regulation as a whole, largely because of the massive complexity of it. And I agree with Lord Turner, the last head of the FSA, that actually what's required for a financial services regulation is a few simple but very good rules. And if I was sort of global Obergruppenführer of pensions, then I would just make it sort of mandatory straight away, 1% exit fee max.
Yes, and you would definitely have our support.
So the last point on portability is, in a sense, a non-financial one, which is, let's say that I'm global Obergruppenführer tomorrow and I impose a 1% limit. You may still find that a firm like yours, who is helping people consolidate their various bits and bobs into one place and then manage it centrally, that as of tomorrow, the maximum's all 1%, so be it. But actually, that funnily enough, some people are actually a bit more efficient at giving you what they probably feel is their money, their assets under management, and other people drag their feet a little bit more in terms of it's taking them quite a long time to reply to your letters.
This is one of the reasons why, you know, we were so shocked when we started Pension B, to find that if you're doing a transfer, it can be completely luck of the draw in terms of what experience you get. Because most people don't actually choose their own pension to begin with, it's given to them by their employer, there's an extreme lack of competition within the market. And so when you come to move your pension, if you are lucky enough to have had a pension with a forward-thinking provider, they will probably transfer it electronically in a matter of, say, 2 weeks. However, if your employer, and I dare say some of the big banks are very guilty of this, has chosen a pension administrator who refuses to use electronic transfers, then your average transfer could take around 60 days, which is just insane for moving a pot of money.
Yeah, well, this then comes back to, it's my sort of Cohen of the day, really, which is this asymmetry around the massive focus on open banking, which, of course, is a good thing. We assume it's a good thing, we'll find out. But why there is much less of a fuss, or even I rarely heard the phrase open investment at all, because they are the sort of mirror image of each other.
They absolutely are.
And what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander and other such cliches. Anyway, that's the way it is at the moment. So some of them are going to drag their feet, which I think actually for the average listener out there probably just means that actually the sooner you sort of move all your stuff to a bunch of 21st century folks who are acting in the interest of the consumer rather than the producer, that's probably a good thing. Am I allowed to ask you at this point what your exit fee is and time? If I give you all my money and then I decide sort of next week to take it all out, do I get charged a 78% exit fee and you drag
you
your feet for months?
You certainly do not. We do not charge
exit
fees.
That's lucky I felt guilty otherwise.
We don't believe in exit fees. We believe that people should have the freedom to choose their pension provider and to not be locked into long-term contracts that can be detrimental to them. And if you do choose to transfer out, which not many people do, but if you did want to do it, then our preference is to always transfer electronically.
Excellent. Well, I think that's a very good sort of sales point. And we won't get onto the analogy in my mind with long-term contracts. It's very hard to get out of, given that I mentioned divorce before. So let's keep that for another podcast. So then we get on to the question of costs, where once again I hold my head in my hands. I did see something, I think, in the Evening Standard when I sat on it on a train recently about some latest FCA investigation into costs and transparency costs, where after 3 years they decided that more work was required around sort of demonstration costs for the retail public. And I'm so bored of this because, frankly, I heard all these arguments in the 1980s about disclosing costs, and again, my political cynicism to one side. If the state and corporates were actually there for the benefit of the public, then the public should have known 30 years ago what the total costs are of their investments, and I find that a bit of a disgrace. So, costs. Let's take an example. So, I've got my couple of pension schemes. I have no idea what the costs are.
Well, you wouldn't be alone.
I'm a very ignorant person.
Around 51% of people are not even sure whether there are any costs, right? So, they don't even know that they may be being charged, because pensions are often positioned as a service that you get for free. And I guess it comes back to the fact that your employer organizes this.
Historically, it didn't matter what the costs were because you were given a defined stream of money at the end. So they had to do whatever it took. They could take a 10% of cost per annum, but when I retire from, you know, my big co I've been with 30, 40 years, it doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, it was the employer's problem.
Yeah, exactly.
That's now it's your problem. And we are fortunate enough to have a cap on pensions that are used for auto-enrollment. So that's where your company puts you into a pension scheme as part of its legal obligations. So those charges are capped at 0.75%, and that's a good thing. However, there are many pensions out there where the costs are completely not transparent. And my favorite example is where the pension provider will show you what they call a platform fee and tell you that this is the cost that you are paying. But actually, there is also an underlying fund management fee that is, in my opinion, secretly being charged without the consumer being aware of it. And if you think about the way that we shop in life, you know, I don't walk into a store and look at the price and assume that that's around half of what I'll pay. And then somewhere along the way between the shelf and the till, I'm going to get charged double what I think I'm paying.
Absolutely. And I think it can be even worse than that. So you talk about the platform fee, the fund fee, but then there can also be custody fees and other sorts of miscellaneous that disappear separately, which aren't aggregated, which I think was the thing that the FCA sort of said it's going to spend a few more years considering. So even in a simple case, I mean, I don't actually know how it is, but let's take the Legal & General fund I mentioned before. Even this simple case of Legal & General, I wouldn't be 100% convinced that, for the sake of argument, let's say Legal & General charged me 75 basis points on a fund, that there aren't a few more things disappearing in custody and miscellaneous and T&E, and you mentioned it.
Well, the good news is that when you are in an index fund, the additional costs are usually quite low because you are not constantly trading in and out of various different stocks, which is what tends to generate transaction costs. And so you're probably okay, but it's definitely a good idea to get on top of the situation.
But again, I think the North Star is very simple and very clear here, as it has been for decades, and goodness knows why it hasn't been implemented, which is that people who have money invested on their behalf should know what the total fees are.
Yes.
We'll come on to Pension B in a minute, but one thing which I didn't immediately grasp from your website in my in-depth sort of 30-second flick through on my phone was that your fees are actually, we'll come on to what they are on in a minute because you've got some interesting developments happening soon, that your fees are total fees.
That's right. So they include the fund fee.
Everything.
Yes. And it's actually good because we want to be leading the market in the way that fees are disclosed. But sometimes others, when they compare us, assume that there is a secret underlying fund fee that just doesn't exist. And so when they compare us to other pension providers, it may look like it's expensive, but actually what we're giving is an all-in cost.
Right. So then the last category we've spoken about in the information age is this whole subject of data. And pensions are a very old industry and some of it is very antiquated. And I remember you was telling me that quite a lot of data is still kept on paper in the first place.
Yes, there is actually a giant archive sitting on level minus two of most pension companies where pension records are stored. And in preparation for the pension dashboard, some consultants did some work on the data and found that in certain instances, up to 25% of it can be inaccurate. And I presume those are just inaccuracies that we can spot. So, for example, a date of birth having three digits in the year instead of four.
Yes, absolutely. Well, now I understand more how my value doubled and halved over the space of a year. Because if someone went down to the sort of basement a couple of floors below and the light was a bit dark, they just got the wrong folder out and wrote a number on the back of their hand or something like that.
Would not surprise me.
Okay, so that's all quite shocking, but hopefully the pensions dashboard will, over time, increase the pressure on old school providers to actually start using these computer things. Even computer things, of course, don't actually mean that your data is clean, because anybody involved in data in the world knows that it's necessary to clean your data before you do it to avoid the garbage in, garbage out. And just briefly, GDPR, this EU directive next year around data, how will that impact the pensions world?
Well, I think most pension providers today are focused on whether they have permission to use their customers' data in the way that they are using it and what is the reason for that permission. But to me, the more interesting principle is the principle around data portability. And so under GDPR, consumers can tell their pension provider to share their data in a way that generates value for the consumer. So that actually is very open banking similar, but it remains a question to be seen how pension providers will interpret the guidance. I've seen some proposals that apparently it's okay to share data over paper. I would strongly argue that that goes against the spirit of the legislation. So I think as soon as it comes into force, you'll be hearing us through Robinhood talking about what pension providers are doing to meet the portability requirements.
Excellent. You remind me of one of my first jobs in the city. I was at Climate's 8:30 in the evening, and my job was faxing to Malaysia an investment proposal which had about 40 pages in it, and the fax machine kept going wrong.
I will have you know there are still pension providers who use fax.
Oh, great. Well, I can still get a job if the podcasting doesn't work out. Good. Okay, well, before we wrap up, I'd like to thank all the listeners out there. I was about to say I hope too many of you haven't been worried about the fact that you didn't get a piece of paper on one of your pensions last year, but maybe that's a good thing. If you are a little bit worried, maybe you should go and get your pieces of paper and check that something isn't missing. And whatever country you're in, maybe you should think a little bit more about how to make your life a bit simpler in terms of knowing what your pension investments are all over the place, what this means for the future. And I'm a very bad person on this one myself, but I know I shouldn't be, of actually having some strategy in terms of being able to retire at some point in the future and knowing how much you should be able to save. So good luck to you all with that. I'd like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, my even more award-winning, as of last week, brand partners for the podcast, Blue Motor Finance, who combine extensive experience with a fresh and innovative approach. Blue's award-winning technology has supported over £500 million of lending to over 50,000 customers. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. So now normally I ask my guest to wave a few flags to throw some breadcrumbs on the water for the thousands of fishes out there. But in your case, Romy, as you've been very kind and focusing on this huge mess of pensions, and I'm certainly a lot clearer about the dimensions of what's happening in the industry, I think it'd be just quite good if you can just give us a little bit of a rundown for a few minutes about what PensionB does. I believe you're in the UK at the moment, so for the thousands of people listening to this from the UK, what actually are you selling them for how much?
Sure, so PensionB is an online pension manager, and we help people to find and combine their pensions from previous periods of employment or personal pensions into one new online plan managed by some of the world's biggest money managers. So with PensionB, your money is managed by BlackRock, State Street, and Legal & General. And once you've combined with PensionB, you can log in online on your phone or on your desktop. You can see your balance on a daily basis. You can forecast retirement outcomes, so see how much that pot of money is actually going to get you later on, and very quickly realize that you should be making contributions. And so we enable easy contributions from this week onwards with direct debit. And therefore, we think that we are a great place for people to be planning and managing their retirement.
As I understand it, formally at the moment, you have a web-based portal for looking at this, because I've seen, I mean, I think the Daily Mail I saw said, oh, you know, PensionB's app. Well, I don't think you have one at the moment.
So we have a web app.
And a web app is?
Well, it means we are mobile optimized for any phone, but we are not sitting on people's desktop as a native app.
Yes, exactly. So I want to make that clear, so people didn't sort of rush off to Google Play or wherever it is on iTunes and start looking for PensionB and then wonder whether you're real because they didn't find you there.
We're real.
You're very real, exactly. And you're going very fast and busy raising various rounds of funding. So in terms of if I go and aggregate all my pensions to you, we mentioned the fact that the portability is good. You help the pensions be sucked in the first place, and you don't charge exit fees if I change my mind a little bit later. And in terms of the fact you mentioned also the total fees, so off the top of my head, you've got three particular offerings at the moment, and those fees are going down next week in some cases.
They are indeed. So we charge between 0.5% and 0.95% on an all-in basis, so including platform fees, fund fees, etc., depending on which plan you pick. And from next week onwards, on pensions over £100,000, we will be giving customers 50% off on balances above that amount.
Excellent. Well, one of my critiques of the whole, just use the word fintech, of the whole fintech investment sector has been that by and large, they're charging old school prices. And I'd be more interested in the investment sector as a whole, as and when they can get to the stage where they're kind of quotes more truly digital and start charging an order of magnitude less. And certainly, you know, halving 0.5% to 0.25%, you're definitely going in that direction. So in terms of folks out there, they can definitely check you out on your website. You're very highly rated on Trustpilot, I think I saw, 9 something out of 10. And what are the breadcrumbs do you want to throw into the water?
Well, I guess one of the things that we really enjoy doing is partnering with other like-minded institutions. So we currently have partnerships with Revolut, ClearScore, and recently The Telegraph. These partnerships are a way for us to work together to offer a pension consolidation product to the customer base of the partner. Because of auto-enrollment, most people these days do have a pension and they do want to manage it online. And so we see PensionBee as a great way to add value to the audience bases of our partners.
Excellent. Well, I think it's a very interesting topic. I say it's a very interesting topic. Most people regard it as very boring, but I can tell you, listening to my father moan non-stop about his pension and the state regarding him and his generation who rebuilt the country after the war as a burden upon the state when they've contributed for decades, that actually, even if you regard it as a boring topic now, you definitely won't when you retire, because it will be your income. It's interesting that it is changing. I hope it does change in the speed that you're talking about in terms of the optimism. I think some of it will and some of it won't, but it's a really important topic for everyone, and I think the takeaway for me, which is just this simple one, that actually, if everybody knew what the value of their pensions was and what it meant, it would change their approach to investment, and rather like not eating sugar and brushing your teeth today. That's the best thing you can do to have sort of good teeth in next time you go to the dentist. It's the same thing, that it always has been the case that the earlier you save for your pension, so much better that it is. And humans are terrible. I think it's what this is called, exponential discount function or something, isn't it? Human beings are terrible at doing things now for the far-off future. We're very good at doing something now for lunchtime or perhaps this evening or maybe the weekend. But the further you go into the future, it sort of somehow it doesn't really exist in our brains.
Well, let's make it easy and engaging. And I think we have a chance of changing that.
Excellent. Well, on that note, I wish you every success in the future. And I hope that PensionBee continues to make this sector clearer and simpler for everyone.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you have consulting, advisory / non-exec, or media needs in the FS or fintech space, get in touch with me at mike@londonfintechpodcast.com.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.